It's the Popmatic Podcast for January 21st, 2015. Dr. King, he was a civil rights leader.
Wow.
Wow.
I don't know where I put her in the show, but you want to know the story behind that song?
Yeah. I do want to know the story behind that song.
My partner went to a very like urban school, and they used to sing that song I just sung. And she said to me, "You didn't sing that song?" I'm like, "No, baby." I was like,
girl.
I went, you know, like, I'm from the holler, right? There was no Dr. King song, right? It's great that the song exists now. It's great, but there was no Dr. King song in my high school, right?
That's funny.
So, but she went to a school where absolutely there is a Dr. King song, and now we both sing it. But because I didn't know the song, like, I always screw up the melody. Like, that. Those are the lyrics, but, like, I will be reprimanded publicly, probably in the comments.
Corrections.
If I did know the melody, I couldn't sing it right anyway. But, okay, with that, that's the story of the Dr. King song. This is the Popmatic Podcast, where you can rock out with your library card out. I'm Brian, and joining me today are...
Bill.
Jeremy.
Amanda.
Mike.
We hope you enjoyed Martin Luther King Jr. Day. The memory of Dr. King is even larger in everyone's mind this year because of the release of Selma, a historical drama about Dr. King's march from Selma to Montgomery in 1965. Now, you may have heard that a lot of churches around town are buying up all the seats to the movie. A lot of theaters are letting kids in for free if they have their student ID. So if you have trouble getting a seat to go see Selma, or if you just can't get enough history from that period, we're going to tell you about the best books, movies, and music that have something to do with civil rights era America. And if you went to see Selma, you might have noticed a lot of the real life people in the movie have deep Nashville connections. So people like Diane Nash, played by Tessa Thompson. And you know what? If someone's going to play me in a movie, it's not bad. It's Tessa Thompson, you know. James Bevel was played by Common. Now we're going to talk about the dramatic arts probably mostly today. But if you want real history, you should come to the Civil Rights Room in our Special Collections Department. You can see pictures of the real Diane Nash, the real James Bevel, the real C.T. Vivian, pictures of Dr. King when he was in Nashville. That's just the tip of the iceberg. Come find out why historians, scholars, tourists come from all over the country to see our Civil Rights Room. It's kind of amazing. Can you do a cold open, Amanda?
Yeah. I read a lot of books that are kind of civil rights-y, like The Help and To Kill a Mockingbird, which I think Bill's going to talk about later. But I actually stumbled across one a couple years ago called The Story of Beautiful Girl, and it's by Rachel Simon. So the premise is it's 1968, and Lenny is a young white woman, and she has a developmental disability. And so her family is kind of embarrassed by this, and they have stuck her in the Pennsylvania State School of the Incurable and Feeble-Minded, which aren't we glad that we've changed names over the course of, you know, several decades. And she still has contact with her sister because her sister's still close with her, but her family pretty much is ignoring her. And while she's there, she meets a gentleman named Hellman, and he's African-American, and he's deaf. And he's also been abandoned by his family. And so over the course of the beginning of the book, they kind of fall in love. And at one point, they escape together from the school, and they kind of live in the country for a few days. And while they're out, Lenny actually gives birth to a daughter named Julia. And they find refuge in a farmhouse of this teacher, Martha. And they know that the authorities are right on their tail. And so Homan gets away, but Lenny gets captured. And before they take her away, she gives the baby to Martha and says, "Hide her." So the rest of the book follows the story about how, you know, what Lenny's life is like when she goes back to the school and what Homan's life is like when he's out kind of trying to make a life for himself and supporting himself as a deaf man, as an African-American deaf man in the 60s, nonetheless, in Pennsylvania. And then what happens with Martha raising baby Julia. And so it's interesting to see how the lives kind of weave in and out of each other. And it really is a good love story. It's not sappy like you think, oh, we're all going to cry. It's not super sappy, but...
I would cry.
but I really did enjoy it. My book club actually read it, and we had a good discussion about it. And this one came out in 2011. And in real life, Rachel Simon, she has a developmentally disabled sister, and she had actually released the book called Riding the Bus with My Sister in 2002. And that documents her life. Her sister loved to ride around on the city buses. And it may sound familiar because there was a Hallmark Hall of Fame movie that was made with the same title. It stars Rosie O'Donnell and Annie McDowell as the two sisters in the book. So if you were curious, I would check out all of these things. I haven't had a chance to read Riding the Bus with My Sister yet, but I do want to. All right, Mike.
Saw that today. I would talk about a film from 1863 called Shock Corridor, directed by Samuel Fuller. Basically, it's kind of a film noir, even though it's just right outside the film noir era. A murder has occurred in an insane asylum, and like 6 months later, the police still have no idea who did it. So a journalist named Johnny Barrett, smelling a Pulitzer Prize, decides to infiltrate the asylum by pretending that his fiancée is his sister. Gets a doctor to commit him for incest. There are three possible witnesses to the crime. Barrett must spend each time buttering up to each of them, and that's like most of the movie is him trying to like get an in with the three witnesses and break their neuroses and see if they did indeed witness the murder. Ooh. First witness is a guy named Stewart, a guy who believes that he's a Civil War general, cavalryman guy, J.E.B. Stewart. Jeb Stuart. Turns out that he was captured during the Korean War, and the North Koreans Manchurian candidated him. But now they brainwashed him into becoming a communist agent. But when Stewart tried to convert a fellow POW, the POW's patriotism broke him, and the North Koreans headed him back to the United States, saying he was nuts. The United States, dishonorably discharged him and called him a traitor. So, he went mad. Witness two is a guy named Trent, an African-American guy who was the first to integrate an unnamed Southern university. Being constantly surrounded by bigotry and hate drove him insane. He now believes himself to be a member of the Ku Klux Klan. He constantly screams hate speech and has to be segregated from other black inmates because he's constantly attacking them. Witness three is Bowdoin, a scientist who developed a new kind of ICBM. When he finally realized the devastation that his life work could cause, he mentally regressed from a brilliant scientist to the mind of a small child. There are some really kooky characters in the asylum. One of my favorite bits is where Barrett was trying to escape from the guards, and he goes through this door, and inside the door is a bunch of women, and they slowly turn to him, and he looks at them, and then they run at him, and he goes, "No, nymphos!" This is the 60s, and, having women tear off your clothes would be a bad thing. Shock Corridor has a definite, ripped from the headlines vibe to the plot, which is surprising to modern eyes and rare for B-movies at the time. The Manchurian Candidate movie had come out the year before. Also, in 1962, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals ordered the University of Mississippi to allow African-American James Meredith to attend. And the Cuban Missile Crisis was also in 1962. But for me, at least, and the most tragic and relatable of the, crazy witnesses is... Trent. Really felt bad for him, you didn't really think about how all that kind of hate would kind of warp. But the real life inspiration for him, James Meredith, would go on to lead a thing called a March Against Fear in 1966 from Memphis, Tennessee to Jackson, Mississippi. He graduated with a law degree from Columbia, and he ran for various public offices. And he now has a statue at the University of Mississippi, and he's given talks about his experiences, and he sounds like a really interesting guy, at least according to Wikipedia, which, as a bastion of possible maybes.
That's on their banner, right? Their banner head?
Yeah, one of the... I was going to say something, but they said citation needed, so I'm not going to say it. But what have you got, Jeremy?
I'm taking a different approach to the subject. In recounting the origins of the X-Men for Marvel Comics, writer Stan Lee grafted a Martin Luther King, Malcolm X dichotomy to the tale of good mutants led by Professor Charles Xavier and evil mutants led by Magneto. Now, how much this is true is up for debate because, you can attach significance after the fact to something that you've created, and that can help embellish your own legacy, which is something Stan Lee would never do.
Pish posh.
or, it's a case of Lee realizing what he was subconsciously thinking as he stood at his typewriter, because he liked to stand while he was writing.
The more he lies, the more open his shirt gets.
That's right. That's right. The more he lies, the more bottles of cologne he sells, because he has a cologne.
Ooh, a scent.
I think it's called Excelsior.
Of course it
Excelsior!
Is.
Excelsior!
True believers.
Uh-huh. So, and the X-Men appeared in 1963, which is just 1 year before the Civil Rights Act was passed. I'm waiting to see if that's going to be in the corrections, because I'm pretty sure that's correct. I checked, but I feel like I didn't check. So anyway, that was a year before the Civil Rights Act passed. So it is very likely that Stan Lee and his co-creator Jack Kirby took the news of the day in, and then some of it bled out into their work. And X-Men comics mutants are people born with special abilities. Some of these abilities manifest themselves in easily hidden ways, throwing on some glasses, putting on a suit or something, and hiding the wings that are spreading out of your back. Sometimes they result in hideous deformities. This is an elastic concept which allows mutant abilities to represent a whole host of differences, especially since the series continues to this day, from race and religion to sexual identity. And Marvel introduced us to the neurotic superhero in Spider-Man, the superhero team as bickering family in the Fantastic Four, so allowing the human trait, the all-too-human trait of bigotry, to occupy the same space as ads for X-ray specs and sea monkeys makes total sense. In 1982, an X-Men graphic novel appeared called God Loves, Man Kills by Chris Claremont and Brent Anderson. And it's the story of a television preacher who, it's revealed, killed his wife and son after his son was born a deformed mutant. And this guy goes on a crusade against mutants and saying that they're abominations, and he uses religion as a to justify wiping out all of mutants. He debates Professor X on TV and then kidnaps him and then basically brainwashes him into using his brain powers to kill all the mutants. And then the good guys, the X-Men, team up with their arch enemy Magneto, who also knows a thing or two about being oppressed, and they rescue Professor X, save the lives of millions of people who just happen to be born different.
And you can see all this in X-Men 2.
Yes, yeah. Except he's a military guy, not a preacher.
And his son is still alive.
Oh, that's true. Okay. It's been a while since I've seen
it. Do we have some spoiler alert somewhere in there?
Oh, well, you know, if you miss this movie from, like, 2001.
That's just the setup, right? That's not how the plot resolves itself.
That's fair enough. Superhero comics in general and the X-Men in the 1980s specifically are dramatically structured like soap operas, I think, with superpowers standing in for the wealthy and beautiful people, and ads for video games replacing ads for detergent and hygiene products. So it sort of requires a leap of faith to believe that there is any sort of true social relevance to a story featuring a character called Magneto. But I think that stories like this and others like it sort of point out the ridiculousness of our prejudices by putting them in silly costumes and four colors and sort of boiling them down and letting us see them at sort of in their simplest form. So it works on the funny book pages and it works in real life.
My favorite X-Men thing is that he got tired of coming up with origin stories. So for X-Men, it's just like they were born.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's
good. Like intellectual laziness.
Basically, it's like, you know, after, you know, Fantastic Four and Spider-Man and all that kind of stuff, he's like, he just writer's block.
Coming up with implausible accidents.
Yeah, puberty did it.
Well, that makes total sense. Bill?
Well, I want to talk about a book and the movie To Kill a Mockingbird. I believe Amanda discussed this book during Banned Book Week. Am I correct?
Yeah, we've mentioned it before.
Okay, and well, I'm going to mention it again because it's an American standard. The book To Kill a Mockingbird is a beloved, wildly successful, and one of the most taught books in school, and the subject of being banned from schools. I know more people have written and discussed the power of both novel and film, so what could I say that would bring any new perspective to the novel and the movie? Well, it's one thing I've noticed that people don't mention about it is I feel To Kill a Mockingbird has a quiet power, and the fact that it's told from the perspective of the child's point of view helps the story tremendously. There aren't loud speeches or great acts of violence or action. It's the simplicity of the way Harper Lee tells this story of racial injustice. And while I'm recommending the book and the movie, I'm also highly recommending this great documentary called Hey Boo, Harper Lee, and To Kill a Mockingbird. And it's a very insightful DVD about the reclusive Harper Lee and what the book means to many people. The movie To Kill a Mockingbird, of course, the book, and this DVD, Hey Boo, Harper Lee, and To Kill a Mockingbird.
I feel like there's a book that just came out on the 50th anniversary that was written by her neighbor.
Yes, we have it. I can't remember the title, though.
Yeah,
that's the thing.
It's like
and there's
Harbor,
been some controversy
because
she may or may not have allowed her to write the whole book.
Not 100% accurate.
Maybe.
Didn't something happen to her where she accidentally signed the rights away to the book or something?
Yeah. Yes. To the publisher, I think.
Yeah. To Kill a Mockingbird.
For a long time, she lost the rights to
Harper Lee's about blind. She's like 90. She's about blind, too. And there's some skullduggery there.
Yeah.
It was a really interesting article on Slate where she moved from her, was it Alabama?
Mm-hmm.
To New York City, like really late in life, like recently, because she got tired of the cottage industry of To Kill a Mockingbird stuff in her hometown.
Mm.
And people would go to her house, and she didn't, you know, she doesn't want to talk to crazy rando strangers.
Yeah.
You know, and she got tired of all the merchandising.
Is she like Salinger and allegedly have like drawers full of books that have been unpublished, or
She wrote like a short story or something. She hasn't really done anything
since. Yeah, she
hasn't really. Not that I know of.
She says she started on stuff, but yet it was kind of, you know, she hit out of the ballpark on that documentary goes into that.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, cool. Yeah, okay.
And then there's also, which I would like to dispel, Truman Capote did not write To Kill a Mockingbird.
What do you mean?
he would have bragged about that, you know.
Yeah, he would.
If you ever saw him on a talk show, he would have bragged and tooted his horn.
He was unafraid of. Yeah, he's not very humble.
Even things he supposedly wrote about the upper class answered prayers of that book, that was all a fraud, you know.
That is the best evidence that he did not write.
Nobody brings that up, so it's here.
You heard it on the podcast. So the book that Amanda was talking about was The Mockingbird Next Door,
Life
with Harper Lee by Marja Mills. And it's still on the bestseller list, mm-hmm. on the indie bestseller list. Yeah.
We've got it. I catalog.
I checked it out, but I haven't read it yet.
In my continual failure to just be the host and not be a contributor to the Popmatic podcast, I could not decide what I wanted to talk about today. And so I'm just going to talk about everything that came to my mind, but I'm just going to do like two sentences on each. Okay, first, Long Division by Kesey Lehman. My book club read it. Oh, this is such a good book. It's set in contemporary times, but it's like this 13-year-old kid in Jackson, Mississippi. But in the woods behind his grandmother's house, he finds like this hole in the ground that's actually like a portal to different parallel universes.
Cool.
And he keeps going through it. And even though every time he goes through it, he's in the same Mississippi town, but in different time periods. Sometimes it's in the future, sometimes it's in the past. Mm. But what's even better is the different versions of himself that he finds in these different time periods. He finds another book called Long Division with a lead character with the same name.
Oh.
And then in the different parallel universes, they're reading the same book. And it keeps cutting back and forth between like the novel within the novel. It's freaking great. And what it's really about is Mississippi and the Klan and the civil rights battles in Mississippi in this one particular little town is really freaking good. Has the best scene with a KKK member doing the Egyptian dance in front of a MacBook you ever read. It's just, you got to read
it. Some bad ones. Like,
I went to a Klan rally one time on the opposing side, and they weren't doing that at all.
So somehow I managed to not say two sentences, and you guys ended up talking about KKK on the civil rights episode. Oh, never.
You started it.
I know, I did. I did.
Pointing fingers.
You got to insert the KKK took my baby away.
You can't have the good. You can't have the good. You can't have the good without the bad.
That's right.
Okay, number two, Malcolm X, A Life of Reinvention by Manning Marable. Manning Marable spent his whole life writing this book. It's a scholarly, comprehensive biography of Malcolm X. It came out just a few years ago, and then Mr. Marable died. It was kind of weird. Mike has talked about the life-altering power of Malcolm X's biography as told to Alex Haley. It's very much a memoir. You know, it has a lot of poetic power. Malcolm X, Life and Reinvention, more of a scholarly work. It's a great book. I totally recommend it. Along the same vein, Black Against Empire, The History and Politics of the Black Panther Party by Joshua Bloom. I wrote about it on Off the Shelf blog. A great book. That book is very neutral. It's just about, okay, this is what the political platform of the Black Panther Party was. This is what they accomplished. A little bit later in time period, Black Power Mixtape was a compilation of footage made by Swedish television crews in the United States in the late 60s and early 70s about the Black Power movement.
Of course, really good.
This just went into a can for years, and now it's been released on DVD. But back to the civil rights, what some people would say the civil rights era proper, the Soundtrack for a Revolution, which is a documentary about the role that music played in the civil rights era. You know, when people were marching, they would sing. When people were put in prison, they would sing to, like, help them get through the prison sentence, you know, like, help, you know, to lift their spirits and, you know, help them stay positive when they were in prison. But the Soundtrack for a Revolution is very interesting because it's a documentary about the history, but also they get contemporary artists to sing the songs. It's like a documentary and a concert film. So, like, John Legend and the Roots are there performing songs from the era. We have the DVD. We have the actual soundtrack to A Soundtrack for a Revolution, so you can listen to all the performances. And on February 18th, 11:30 to 12:30 here in the Special Collection Center, they will play an encore performance of A Soundtrack for a Revolution. Special Collections Department has this little film series called Film for Thought. The first time they showed this film, it completely filled the Special Collections Center. The people were out in the hallway, so they're going to show it again. Soundtrack for a Revolution, February 18th, 11:30 to 12:30, right here at the Downtown Public Library in the Special Collections Center. Mike, what do we do on the Tickle My Fancy segment?
Why, we talk about things that tickled our fancy?
Okay.
Things that, you know, may not go with the theme of the week, but that, you know, amused us in the past week. But in my case, for my fancy tickler, I'd like to take you back in time to the distant year of 2014, when Iggy Azalea was on the charts and North Korea told us to what we could watch.
I'm sorry, that was me drifting back in time. Yeah.
It wasn't until the day of recording our Best Books episode that I discovered that we could list runners up. Oh, and I've been trying to, like, sneak in my runners up since then, but things have come up, you know, in subsequent tickles. So here are my top five books that I would have put in the list if I could have fit them in. I'm going to try to talk as fast as I can, and I always talk fast, so this could be really interesting. Ready to go. Okay, so the first book is The Psychopath Test by John Ronson, which begins as a survey of psychopathy, what makes a psychopath. It goes to a fascinating digression to mental illness in general, and the history of the DSM manual, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual for Mental Disorders. Fun fact, if you're worried that you're a psychopath, you aren't, because psychopaths don't worry about anything. They're 100% confidence. Like Brian.
Yeah, I was just doing the Silence of the Lambs dance.
Yeah, you know. I still haven't been to those other rooms in his house. There could be bodies and stuff, you know. This is where the previous mics from the previous podcast are from. Next up is Unruly Places, Lost Spaces, Secret Cities, and Other Inscrutable Geographies by Alistair Bonnet. A really fun survey of different geographical oddities from around the world with accompanying Google Maps coordinates. A good example that comes to mind is a city in the North Korean side of the DMZ that is completely uninhabited but is brightly lit and blares patriotic songs 24 hours a day. Apparently, this is a model city that was created to entice South Korean guards to cross the border, which has never, ever worked. Next up is The Making of the President, 1964, by Theodore H. White. Ted White created the story of a campaign-style book in 1960. He continues with the contest in 1964 between LBJ and Goldwater. I liked me some political campaign books, unlike everybody else in this podcast.
I like me some campaign books.
You know, let's do presidents. Nah.
Goldwater?
I prefer Silver Spit.
Wow.
White writes this one especially well. Without going into details, we'd be surprised how much political stuff back then still resonates today. Next up is Hull 03 by Greg Bear. The first sci-fi book I read in a while is not part of the Sword and Laser book club / podcast. It tells the tale of a guy with amnesia waking up on a generation ship. Those ships that go by to another planet really, really slowly, so everybody goes to sleep in there. One guy wakes up too early. It's kind of like that movie Pandorum, but good. It talks about destiny, free will, exploration, human nature, all that kind of good stuff, and with creepily genetically engineered beasties, so, you know, I recommend. And last but not least, The Razor's Edge by W. Somerset Maugham, my favorite trying new things / non-genre book of the year. It tells the tale of a guy named Larry, a guy who was traumatized during World War I, and instead of marrying his fiancée, getting a job, and settling down, he instead wanders the world in search of enlightenment. You see his decision affect everyone around him over the course of about 15 years. I found the last page chilling and cool, but ironically, unlike the person who wrote about it in Wikipedia. It's also made to a movie starring Bill Murray. Apparently, that was the movie that Bill Murray wanted to do instead of Ghostbusters, and Sony was like, we'll make any movie you want as long as you go into Ghostbusters. And I was like, okay, I want to make The Razor's Edge, which was a huge flop, and it's only available on Crackle.
Ghostbusters is better.
Yeah, Ghostbusters is so much better. Who you got, man?
Okay, so mine's not that smart. I have a TV viewing experience that I would like to share with everybody. So Last night I sat down and I was watching Fixer Upper on HGTV. And for those of you that don't, Fixer Upper is a couple, Chip and Joanna Gaines. He's the contractor, she's the decorator, and they're married. Mm-hmm. And they go around helping couples buy the worst house in the best neighborhood, and then they help them fix it up in Waco, Texas. That's where they're located. So they were looking through houses last night, and they had a nice couple that owned a coffee shop, and they were, you know, helping them going through the three houses at the beginning that they pick, and then they pick the best one and they fix it up. So there was this house that had these horrible, like, 1970s, like, little mini ball curtains over, like, every doorway. And so they were going this, they called it the movie. They were red, too. Like, it was awesome. Oh. So they walked into this one room, and there was a dead cockroach on the floor in the room. And so they were talking about the room or whatever, and Chip is a big joker, the contractor guy. And so he goes, well, I'm going to eat a cockroach, and just making a joke. And so you think, oh, it's a throw-off comment. And so the husband of the couple goes, well, I'll bet you $50 if you will eat this cockroach. And see, he had picked it up and was holding it between his fingers, you know, and he kind of licked it a little bit, and I was freaking out already. And so he's like, dude, I got 50 on the table if you eat that. And he did. I had a blanket on. I was covered up with it. I stuck that thing in my mouth, and I screamed for so long that my cat came over to see what was wrong with me. And then he, like, showed it in his teeth. How long that cockroach hit. It was dead. And it had been, it could have been there since 1970.
I just had an idea for a show. It's like one of these fixer-up shows plus, like, Fear Factor.
Yes.
Into one thing.
You have to eat whatever you find in the house.
But here's my fear about that. Now, it is gross to eat a cockroach, and I wouldn't want to watch that either, but what if it died because it was poisoned by an exterminator?
Yes, 100%.
I mean, not that... I didn't
even think about that.
That's what I thought. Yeah. That's the first thing I thought.
You know, so if you need a little bit of...
eating garbage.
You know what? That would never happen on Love It or List It.
I tell you what, that's true. Yeah, David would not eat a cockroach.
So I'm going to leave candy in my murder houses from now on.
Got it. Maybe it's just a Texas thing.
You know, when back when the previous swarm of cicadas was around, people were selling tacos and stuff, and burritos with cicadas.
On purpose?
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Yes,
I mean, you can get chocolate.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm not going to do that.
And it might have bothered me less if the thing was alive, but it was dead, bottom up on the floor, and he just...
That just bugged me.
I wouldn't eat a cicada because it looks like a demon.
Yeah.
That's all I'm saying.
Well, it's been in the ground for 14 years like that.
Communing with Satan.
It's like marinating in dog urine and worm guts. I eat a lot of gross stuff, but I mean,
out of all of us here, you'd be the closest one that would come to eating a cockroach.
What? I like chicken livers, and I like combos. Like, those are the grossest things I put in my body.
It's a Making Fun of Jeremy episode.
Apparently.
Well, I wouldn't do it.
Let me go on a rant about everything I've eaten today.
I'd have chicken liver combos before I'd have...
That'd be good, though.
Everything tastes good with fried and butter and garlic, the smell would make me want to eat a cicada, and I'd see its evil, demonic eyeballs, and then I would be like,
I couldn't do the crunchy legs. That's how you lose me.
What's that noise, too? Like, don't you feel like it would, like, take you over and, like, you would just hear it in your stomach? And, like,
I would run screaming around the house.
You just have to do what they do in Snowpiercer. You just grind it up into a paste, and it's like, oh, it's Vegemite.
Oh, that was gross.
It's pretty fresh.
This is the episode that makes me puke.
Bill, what's tickling your fancy?
We're skipping over you because we don't care about you.
Sorry.
We're still shocked.
I derailed the podcast.
Yeah, wow.
Yes.
Good one. All right.
Tickling my fancy this week is cat milk. If you ever had milk from a cat, it's delicious.
Pat.
Get out.
That's not true.
I don't have the power to fire you, but I totally am. I'm going to walk off now.
That's a...
Unlocked door.
You ever sprinkled cat litter on ice cream?
I gotta bring up Dune, right? There's that great scene where it's like, we've poisoned this cat, and you have to take the antidote from the horrible cat scene.
Didn't Bill Gates drink poo water?
He did.
Yeah, it was refined poo water. So it wasn't like, it didn't have poo in it.
Oh, I see. But it had poo in it at one time?
At one time it did.
Waterworld?
That's what I've heard that's been a thing lately, that people do that, repurpose the...
He's trying to, like, prove that you can.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that they're trying to work on machines that do that. So
I have a friend
that is
a huge hippie, dreadlocks... white lady, and she is a proponent of humanure, which is like using...
Yeah.
We understand.
Yeah, I got it. That pun is
genius.
What
else can we talk about today?
Just like my fancy this
week. I
think
it's fun.
Wow, okay, so...
What's actually tickling my fancy was, first, Mike saying the phrase, subsequent tickles.
I did take it.
I feel good.
I wrote that down because I really like that. But also, is truly tickling my fancy and will continue to tickle my fancy is check it out with Dr. Steve Brule, you dingus. So this is from Tim and Eric from the Tim and Eric Awesome Show. Great job, guys. Tom Meets the Mayor and whatever the hell else they've done. I've not really dipped my toes into their weird comedy world. I've seen the Totino's Pizza Rolls commercial that they did, which was incredible and makes me want to eat pizza rolls that are not filled with bugs. This is like sort of a fake cable access show in which John C. Reilly plays Dr. Steve Brule. He's a mumble-mouthed host.
I don't know anything about that.
And he checks stuff out like animals, pleasure, money, and boats, except he says broats, and he says everything wrong. He calls people dinguses, which is like kind of amazing. And like anytime there's a guy who sort of threatens his masculinity, I guess, he says, you're just a hunk or whatever. I cannot describe why it's funny. I could describe things that made me laugh out loud during it, but it wouldn't be funny if you... But it is hilarious, and there's these weird wonky edits where like the tape goes wrong and stuff, and it rewinds itself or like clicks off and cuts to something really fast and then cuts back. And then there's like these news and sports updates, like yesterday's weather and your fortune and sports and there's movie reviews. And they're from these like non-actors who are reading this nonsense, and you sort of see like they're really trying to make sense of this nonsense. I cannot really describe why it's amazing, but it is amazing. So check it out.
I like John C. Reilly.
According to the People's Encyclopedia, he's actually using the word dingus correctly.
Ooh.
So dingus is a placeholder name that can refer to objects or people whose names are temporarily forgotten, irrelevant, or unknown in the context which they are discussed.
Not just for entertainment.
We just said...
So sorry, library just killed the party.
No, that's not... He doesn't say, hey, dingus. He says, like, you dingus? Like, he says it as a pejorative.
Oh, well, I was just going to be like, I just made myself out to be a dingus.
You did? Don't be such a dingus, you dingus. It was good. Bill?
Tickling my fancy and nothing gross.
Please don't.
Great Train Robbery, not the Edwin S. Porter silent film or the great Sean Connery, Michael Crichton, written and directed from his book. The Great Train Robbery I'm recommending is an engrossing two-part television miniseries that aired on the BBC in December 2013. We now have it on DVD, and it tells the true story of the robbery of the Royal Mail train that was going from London to Glasgow on August 8, 1963. The BBC dramatization of the event is done in two parts. First, a robber's tale, and second, a copper's tale. Luke Evans plays Bruce Reynolds, the mastermind of the robbery, and the great Jim Broadbent is DCS Tommy Butler, who leads the investigative unit. I highly recommend The Great Train Robbery, and also if anybody from Criterion is out there listening, please release Robbery, Peter Yates' 1960 film, which also details the same robbery. Brian?
Radical. I dig that totally. So what's tickling my fancy is that Mike said, I'm going to leave candy in my kill houses.
and murder house.
And that went without comment by anybody.
Like, I was really clever. Nobody cared. I was like, okay.
I was thinking like, go back to my corner. I guess. Yeah.
Well, you know, they ate a cockroach in a creepy abandoned house, whatever.
Apparently you could also just leave cockroaches behind and just still kill some people.
So you catch more flies with honey, though, is what they say.
Why do you want flies?
They're delicious.
Apparently.
You ever had tzatzis? Tzatzi tacos?
Okay, so what is really tickling my fancy this week?
I got to get in on this. You ever had puss custard?
Okay.
Wow.
All right. Puss custard?
Mine.
I don't know.
They said puss custard at first. And I was like, whoa. Well, podcast after dark. And I'm like, oh, my.
Did you ever watch that show that Jay Leno had on at 10 o'clock?
Oh.
Okay.
Okay.
That's a low blow. Get my buddy Pat Morita after you.
I couldn't. I just And watching that show is kind of like taking a big bite of a pus custard. Yeah. So
I like custard too, man.
Not anymore.
Not anymore, yeah. Okay, what is actually tickling my fancy is that the Popmatic podcast is now on the Stitcher app. If any of you guys know Stitcher, it's sort of, Vulgate would be iTunes for Android, but it's cross-platform. It works on any computer, any phone, and it's an app. It's a podcast catcher, but then I think it's called Stitcher because you can stitch them together. You can group them all together. Like, these are all my news podcasts. These are all my sports podcasts. These are all my book podcasts. These are all my whatchamacallit podcasts.
Podcasts After Dark.
Yeah, After Dark podcasts. These are all my gross food podcasts, et cetera.
Murder House podcasts.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, Murder House
podcasts.
How do
you podcasts. Know about my groupings, huh?
But we always say iTunes, and, you know, we're everywhere. We're not just on iTunes. And I like for just also, you know, just for me, if you don't know how to use an RSS feed, that means you don't know how to use the internet. I would say your mileage would vary on the privacy permissions on any app, but we are on Stitcher now, and that really is super exciting. So check us out on Stitcher if you don't want to check us out on the iTunes. Corrections! The only one correction that I know of, I actually corrected in the episode, is that the Agrippa code had been cracked.
Yeah, it's very cool how you did that in the podcast.
I outsourced that to other people. I will let that one pass, though. I'm not going to get on Amanda's case about that because she admitted that she went through a Keanu Reeves phase, and that's...
It was a weak moment, okay? That's a bold. He only has a good movie.
I'm a little curious. Do you like Point Break?
I do like Point Break.
Yeah,
I gotta see that.
I've never seen that.
It's a good movie.
Catherine
Bigelow. Johnny Utah.
Yeah,
he's the
football player, surfer.
Swayze,
FBI agent.
Rest in peace. When Patrick Swayze died, it was with my wife. We were walking on the campus of our alma mater. We were walking along, and someone sent her a text message, but she got the text message and she saw it, and she stopped in her tracks and started crying because Patrick Swayze was dead.
Wow.
Like Dirty Dancing connection?
Yeah, I think from being a girl. Then I put her in the corner and everything was fine. Sorry, I didn't put her in a corner.
Oh, baby.
I didn't put her in a corner.
I liked him in Donnie Darko. Okay.
I like Ghost. Not really the romance stuff, but like the demon things in Shadows.
What about cool. Roadhouse? Is there no Roadhouse?
Roadhouse. That's right. Pain don't hurt.
Pain don't hurt.
The only thing missing from my trophy room is your ass.
Did Pinter write that?
What?
Did Harold Pinter write that?
He should have.
Rest in peace, Mr. Swayze. for more info,
for more throat ripping action, go to
for all of this and more, you can go to www.library.nashville.org. And our theme music is by
Adam Dean.
Hey man, you should leave a comment on the blog, on iTunes, rate us on iTunes, anywhere else you find us on the internet. If you like us, if you hate us, if we get something wrong, if we get something right, let us know. Next week's show, we are going to plant a seed in your mind.
Dun, dun, dun.
Can I do it cold? Is this even going to work? The intro is long.
It's the Pop Mag Podcast for July. Julinuary.
We'll see how much of you gets left in this episode. I would like to recommend...
Did you want me to show up this week? Yeah. I would like this comic book. Okay, well then.
How did you know I was going to talk about a comic book?
I didn't see that coming.
Down in my office, I have this thing. Every time you say the word seek, I put a notch on the... Like, it's filled with notches, like, in my office.
It's just come in and just see the whole wall.
It's just filled with notches, and you're like, what's that? I'm like, I don't know.
It looks like a prison.
Nothing at all.
That's awesome.
Sharpening a knife.
Listeners love these in-jokes.
You dingus.